Today we are having the pleasure of being addressed by a prominent British general and diplomat, General Sir Nigel Powat. He's a Knight Commander of the Bath, Companion and Distinguished Service Order. He has spent three periods of service for his country on assignment in the Far East with headquarters in Singapore. And altogether, he has been 35 years in the British diplomatic and military service. He took over as commander in the Far East with the Eastern Land Forces after a brilliant record as director of plans at the War Office and as deputy commander of the British military mission in Greece. Leadership of the 5th Parachute Brigade on D-Day landing on Normandy beaches. Some of you folks are going to remember D-Day and the fact that the British Parachute Brigade did a very great deal for us at that time. He's had service in Egypt, India, and the Sudan. Qualifies General Powat to predict what communism can and cannot do in Southeast Asia. And we in America, like the British, are equally concerned with what happens in Southeast Asia. And while we do not have land areas there, there are land areas that affect all of us and our economy, our lives, and our future. Because Asia, as you know, is the headquarters in the East, and the whole Pacific Eastern Basin for communism as well as for our way of life. And what happens there is of vast importance to us. It is with a great deal of pleasure that I present to you Sir Nigel Powat.
Mr. President and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for asking me to come and speak to you this morning, and more particularly for inviting me to speak on this very important subject. I think we perhaps tend to use the word vital rather easily, but I'm quite certain that the title, Can the Communists Take Southeast Asia, is absolutely vital to all of us in this room and certainly in my country, in your country. Well now, if I may introduce this subject by saying a word about the background of the threat, because I think that one can't really study this problem without dealing with that in some way. Now, Southeast Asia is in a peculiar position. Every single one of the states, with the exception of Thailand, is a newly emergent state since the war. Every single one, other than Thailand, gained its independence since the war. And it gained that independence under very difficult conditions. During the last few months, really, last year, but more particularly the last few months of the war, we used to a very large extent resistance forces to help operate against the Japanese. And these resistance forces were almost invariably communist resistance forces because it was they and only they who were properly organized to be able to do this. Well, now, when the war came to an end, these resistance forces were the ones who were in a position to take over temporarily the government. The ordinary administrative machine of the various territories, which, as I said before the war, were almost entirely territories, which were colonies or protectorates or dependencies of some sort, the administrations were not ready, and therefore the communists stepped in, and therefore the communists got a position from which they have never been able to be removed. And we see that position very much indeed today. And you must be very alive to it today in Vietnam. There are places in Vietnam, in the Plain of Reeds, in a place they call the Mackie D area, where which have always been communist since they were communist during the war. They were communist throughout the Indochina War, the French Indochina War, and they are still, in those particular areas, predominantly communist today. And that causes a very difficult problem indeed. Now, apart from that, there are many difficulties among the countries themselves, because the boundaries of these countries are not related to the races in between them, but they're mostly related to agreements that were made between the different powers in the older days. And these boundaries are not always recognized by the people who live in them. And history isn't any help, because over the years, invasions have come. Burma's invaded Thailand. Thailand's invaded Burma. The empire of the Khmers in modern Cambodia spread widely over the Southeast Asian Peninsula. The Javanese had footholds on the mainland, and so on. So history is of no help. And therefore we see throughout the area these border disputes going on. We see border disputes or whatever polite word is. There are border issues in India, in Pakistan, in Thailand against Cambodia and Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam. Indonesia took West Irian because of the Netherlands East Indies Empire, because it was part of the former Netherlands East Indies Empire. So this situation with the communists there, the disputes between the different nations in the area, have provided for the communists precisely the sort of situation which they require. And they see in this situation an opportunity to cause difficulties, first of all, for their own to secure expansion, but secondly, to cause difficulties to some of us Western powers who have interests, strategic interests and economic interests in the area, because the area of Southeast Asia is so vital to the whole issue in the Far East with communism in China. Well, now, the people themselves have no desire to get themselves involved in this great power politics, as you might say, the politics between China or the communist countries on one side and the free world on the other. They don't wish to get themselves involved in it, but they are forced to get involved in it because they need assistance in defense and they need assistance in economics to build themselves up from the raw, really, from their independent status. Well, so that is the situation as exists. Now, may I pass from that to see how this background of communism has had an effect. And may I, for just a very few minutes, refer to the Malayan emergency, which dragged on till 1960. It's only a very, very few years ago that it finished. But may I draw attention to that, because I believe it has very important lessons for the situation which exists today. The causes were the same, rather easier for the British in Malaya, because we were able to come in quickly, we were able to come in much greater force than in other places, and we had a government organization ready to take over. But nonetheless, the situation is much the same. And you saw in Malaya, following the campaign, the development of an extraordinarily happy and contented country, which I think may help to dispel some of the anxieties which people may have when they look around that part of the world, more particularly in Vietnam. I think that it shows that a situation of the sort that is being faced in Southeast Asia today, it can be won, provided that it has the support of the people of the country. And therefore, I think we shouldn't be too gloomy about what we see going on. Now, may I just illustrate to you how bad the situation was during this period, because there again, I think a lot of people are very uneasy about what they see going elsewhere. During the worst periods of the Malayan emergency, which lasted, I may say, from 1948 to 1960, 12 years, During the worst period of that, the villages, the outlying villages, were not safe. You couldn't move on the roads. The trade in Malaya itself was not disrupted, but was greatly hampered. The rubber, the tin mines, the palm oil, and all those sort of things were greatly hampered. The planters had to turn their houses into forts, and the whole life of Malaya was completely disrupted. Well, then the campaign was fought, first of all, by Henry Gurney, who was murdered in 1951, followed by Sir General Templer, who brought the campaign to a successful close with his immense enthusiasm and drive and administrative ability. And then the campaign was finally declared to be closed in 1960. Well, I think there are one or two lessons from that campaign which need to be remembered and are being remembered today when the situation in Vietnam is being touched on. And I think the most important factor of all for success, to my mind, is that the campaign in Malaya was fought by the Malays, basically, against the communists who were basically a Chinese immigrant population. It was the Malays who were afraid of the infiltration of a communist population who were not their own and who were going to upset their way of life and absorb large areas of their own country. It was therefore a nationalist campaign. It was the Malays fighting for themselves. And they were fighting with a view to gaining independence. They knew that it was the British government's declared policy then, as the British government's declared policy now, to try and bring to independence all the dependent territories which they had. And the Malays knew well that was the intention. And as soon as the security situation permitted, then independence would be declared, and it was declared. It was declared in 1957, before the emergency was over, but when it was thought that the security situation was adequate. Well, now, the next point, I think, that the next main factor in this was that it was this foreign threat. There were the two main factors. Firstly, independence. They were fighting for their independence. And secondly, they were fighting a foreign threat. Well, now, unfortunately, that does not exist in many other places which we're looking at today. So the thing is not really completely the same. But I think it does show, as I've said, that it is possible to overcome these difficulties, provided you get the will of the people behind you, and provided that there's a real purpose in what is for which the battle is going on. Well, now, gentlemen, I'd like to go on to, from that and trying to use perhaps those lessons, go on to Vietnam, which is, I think, a place which is worrying every single one of you, a place in which the Americans are taking far the greatest burden among the free nations in support, but one in which we ourselves are very deeply interested, because it is no exaggeration to say that the situation in Vietnam is absolutely critical to the security and the battle to prevent communist encroachment in Southeast Asia. Vietnam is absolutely critical. Now, the Vietnamese campaign had many of the appearances of the Malayan campaign, but it had many differences. It's enormously more difficult to start with. The scale of the operation there is immensely greater than anything that we had to cope with in Malaya. We never had anything like the numbers of people who are now in Vietnam. Then again, when we got into Malaya and when the Malayan campaign started, there was a sound civil administration, there was a good police force, there was an army that was well established. Malaya was virtually an island, whereas in Vietnam they have these very long frontiers with Laos and Cambodia and with North Vietnam itself. The seaboard of Vietnam is virtually open. Now, when the French left Vietnam in 1954 as a result of the Geneva Treaty, there was virtually a vacuum left. The civil administration never really had time to get going, and they've suffered all the way through from that bad start. They never had an opportunity of really getting underway. The situation in Vietnam from then onwards began to get worse and worse. From 1954, they had a whole host of troubles with the sects, and then all the way on, 1958, 1959, 1960, until the winter of 61, 62, in about November 61, I went to Vietnam and went all over the place, and all of us who were out there as observers felt that the situation was deteriorating, and deteriorating very fast indeed. And I think that Americans felt that as much as we did. Well, then it was that you began to take a much greater hand in it. You had always been well represented. You had undertaken the training of the Vietnamese army. You had undertaken the support of the Vietnamese economy and a whole host of other things. But when you saw this situation deteriorating, going down so quickly at the end of 1961, you then put in the enormous effort which you've got in there today. You brought in equipment on a very large scale, but I think more important of all, you brought in a really high-grade team of officers and men to assist the Vietnamese in fighting this campaign, to help them in their organization and to help them in the material and in their equipment. And General Harkins and his team of officers and men today has made an immense impression on the situation in Vietnam. He's very much respected throughout the territory of South Vietnam, and he's very much respected by all of us who have been close observers in the area. Well, now, you will ask, what is the situation today? What are the prospects in South Vietnam? Can we be optimistic? You see a whole host of different opinions on this from different people who go and see different things and talk to different people. Well, now, I think that these must obviously be entirely personal opinions, but I say that everybody sees different things and, of course, everybody reaches different conclusions. But I see in the situation in South Vietnam a development. You have succeeded in South Vietnam in producing a situation which could bring an end to the emergency. You've provided what is sometimes called a platform on which a successful campaign could be launched to bring to an end the military side of the emergency. And I'd like to say something about the political side a little bit later, because the political side is probably more important than the military side. But you've produced a situation from which the military side could undoubtedly be won. What have you done? You've made use a great deal of the lessons of the campaign in Malaya. You've helped the Vietnamese policy, but you've given a tremendous amount of help and advice in the formulation of this policy and in carrying it out. You've built an enormous number of these strategic hamlets, which have been very much in the news. More than 5,000 have been built already in the space of a year, which is an amazing achievement. And I don't know exactly what the total is, intended is, but it'll be more than double that, and I shall be very surprised if we don't complete the whole lot by the end of the year. Now, these defended hamlets are an immensely important part of the campaign, because they provide security for the people of the area which the villages are, where they can be looked after, where they can feel safe, and where they can be administered. The trouble in the area is fear that they'll be made to contribute to the Viet Cong, and that they will be able to, and that they will be forced to serve with the Viet Cong, either money or straight service or assistance in some way or other. These villages help to give them the security, which means that they needn't do that. Furthermore, when you have got them collected in the villages and you have provided the sense of security for them, and then they are willing to give the information, and it is only on information that a battle of this sort can be satisfactorily won. So these villages I regard as very important indeed. You've improved the intelligence services enormously. Again, when I say you, I mean the advice that you've given has led very considerably to this, but again, it is a Vietnamese project of which you advise on. The intelligence services have been improved. The army has been trained to deal with the sort of war that is taking place now. It was formerly trained more with an eye to a Korean sort of attack across the 17th parallel. Now it's adjusted to the insurgency type of campaign. But more important, perhaps, than most things, you've improved the coordination and the tie-up between the army, the police, and the political side, and that was where the trouble largely was. There was no coordination between the political policy, what the military were doing, what the police, who were not very important in the country, what they were doing, and the intelligence was reporting to a whole host of different agencies, none of which was being centralized. You've improved that very much indeed. Now this, as I've tried to make out, has been very largely a United States contribution. We have tried to give our contribution too. We are in rather a special position because we are the co-chairman of the Geneva Treaty, which brought about this situation in Vietnam, which led to the division of the country into two. And as co-chairman, we are limited to the sort of things that we can do. But we have sent a mission to Vietnam, who work very, very closely with your people. It's called BRIAM. It's a nice sort of initial business. And it's headed by a man called Mr. Thompson, who was the Secretary of Defense in Malaya, in the Federation of Malaya, during the emergency there. And his purpose is to try and pass on to anybody who wishes it passed on the experience which we gained in Malaya during our emergency. So we are also training quite a number of Vietnamese in our country. They come over to Malaya to be trained, and to Singapore rather mostly, and the Federation of Malaya is training police forces and various other things on behalf of the Vietnamese. Well, now, I shan't have time to talk about Laos and Cambodia. I can't cover the whole subject in 28 minutes, but perhaps you may have questions on that. It's rather hot at the moment. It's rather difficult to keep absolutely up to date with what's happening in Laos. But may I pass on to what I believe is a very important thing in all of our minds at the present moment. I think particularly a lot of people in America are interested in it, and that is the concept of Malaysia. We all know the concern that concept has caused in the Philippines and in Indonesia. Well, now, we believe that the introduction of Malaysia is going to be a most important stabilizing factor in Southeast Asia. We believe that it is going to be a focus for the war against the communism, not the war, but the struggle against communism in Southeast Asia. It will impose an important area which is solidly anti-communist. We think that's very important indeed. Now, the treaty in 1957, which gave independence to Malaya, as I said earlier, as the emergency progressed, that brought together the federated, it's very complicated this, I'm afraid, the federated and unfederated states of Malaya, and the settlements, the old strait settlements of Penang and Malacca, but it left out on a limb Singapore. And it left Singapore out on a limb for a variety of reasons. And I think the main reasons why it left out on a limb is because of the totally different character of the two places. The Federation of Malaya is basically a Mohammedan country, basically Muslims. There are many Chinese and there are many Indians and many other people, but it is basically a Muslim country. Singapore is a Chinese city. And the administration of Singapore was different. The administration had been separated for some years between Singapore and the Federation. So it was left out. That is the plain fact. But Singapore in 1959 was given a constitution with a view during this coming year to have that constitution revised. It was given a form of independent status, which would it had complete control over all its administrative problems except external trade, although it had a good deal of say in that, and defence. It was responsible for internal security with certain provisos. But it was due, this constitution was due to be revised this year. Well, now, the situation in Singapore was causing grave anxiety everywhere, and more particularly in Malaya. The present Prime Minister in Singapore, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, came in on rather a leftish ticket, but when he got responsibility, as is so often the case, he became more and more stable and responsible, and in fact he ran a jolly good government. But there was considerable fear that when the new elections, which is not this year but next year, there's the constitution revised this year and elections next year, when these elections took place, there was considerable fear that he would be overturned and the communists would get in. Well, now, the Malays are very worried indeed about the situation in Singapore. They see Singapore as the Achilles heel of the peninsula. They fear, rather like your Cuba. The parallel is often drawn. They fear that Singapore could become something of that sort, and it could infect the whole of the peninsula. So they're very worried about it indeed. The people in Singapore realize that it must eventually join up with Malaya. It was quite unnatural for it not to be, as a great trading center which draws on all the produce of the Malayan peninsula. So everybody wanted to do it, but there were many difficulties. In 1961, May, the end of May 1961, the Prime Minister of the Federation of Malaya, Tunku Abdul Rahman, made his statement that he wished to bring about a merger between Singapore and Malaya on condition that the Borneo territories would come in as well. And on that has led all this controversy and excitement. Well, now, when there were problems about bringing this thing in, people in Singapore some people in Singapore felt that they wanted to have an independent Singapore, which they saw as in some future an independence, although, in fact, I think they realized it was unviable. People in Malaya feared that the introduction of Singapore, the Chinese of Singapore, the communists, which they feared in Singapore, would overbalance the federation itself. So there was anxiety over that. But as the months rolled by, Singapore people realized that it was the only possibility for their future. And therefore, the leaders moved over. A referendum was held last September, and the referendum showed quite clearly, absolutely predominantly, there was a 90% vote, there's universal suffrage. They were compelled to vote. Every man was compelled to vote, and it was quite clear that Singapore were entirely in favour of it, except for the communists. They were the only people who were against it. So that was cleared. People were worried about the Borneo territories. Many people felt that there was no alternative to the Borneo territories going over. They couldn't do anything else. The total population of all the three Borneo territories is 1.5 million, and there was no possibility of them being independent states. They had to join up as one, and 1.5 million on the borders of Indonesia could not survive. So there again, as time went on, they moved towards the idea of merger. Well, now this, of course, gave us considerable anxiety because we wished to be absolutely certain that they were solidly in favour of Malaysia. And a great many precautions were made to test this opinion. A commission was sent out from England, the Cobhold Committee, which spent 2 months touring the country, testing opinion and so on. They came unanimously to the opinion that was what was wanted. Elections were held in British North Borneo in December, after the Brunei revolt, that is, and overwhelmingly in favour of Malaysia. There will be elections in Sarawak, the third of the territories, next June, and we shall be very surprised if anything different happens. Now, the only place that was at all in doubt was the small state of Brunei, a small state with 88,000 people. Tiny little state, immensely rich because of its oil, and fearing that Malaya wanted to get the riches of oil from Brunei to help stabilize its own economy. People in Brunei pay no taxes, their neighbors pay taxes, so it's very attractive. Well, now this revolt followed an election in Brunei at which a man called Azar Hari, a printer, a former school teacher, got an overwhelming majority. And he led this revolt. We think that he led it because he wanted power, and we think that he probably also wanted to unite the three territories under himself, again, with power. There's no ambition whatsoever of North Borneo to join in with Brunei, but Brunei did, in the old days, hold sway over Sarawak, but they never exercised that sway. They had a purely nominal overlordship. And there was no desire to join up with them. Well, now, this revolt took place in December. It collapsed almost immediately, within a matter of hours. The police never went over. Troops were sent from Singapore, and it collapsed almost immediately. The problem for us was not the collapse of the revolt, to make quite certain that we did not allow to develop in those territories, Borneo territories, something of the character of Malaya. So immense drive was put into the mopping up, and sure enough, they've all come in now, virtually all come in. There was very little support, and so on. But what has happened there to upset the whole situation is this business of the threat of intervention from outside. Well, now, whether that is meant or whether it isn't meant, it has caused us to be extremely alert, and it has caused us to locate in the territories of North Borneo troops and increase the size of the police in a territory that had never had British troops or any troops located in before, and that is the cost of the revolt. It has now had to have troops put in. Well, the revolt is over. Brunei is now indicated its desire to go with the Federation. And the Federation will be declared on the 31st of August this year. All the three territories have now agreed to it, and the process is rolling on for bringing about the necessary legislation. Well, gentlemen, that is my time, and I'd be very glad to answer any questions.
We now come to the second part of our program, the more democratic one, wherein the members write questions which are propounded to our speaker. So, Sir Nigel, if you will return to the lectern with me, we will get on with our question and answer period. The first question is, what is your opinion of the vulnerability of the British Crown Colony of Hong Kong as to overthrow by the Communist Chinese, either by overt action or subversion?
It is always a very difficult problem, this question of Hong Kong. The only reply that I can give to about Hong Kong is that it is the intention of the British government to resist an attack. How successful that will be must depend on the circumstances. It must depend on what sort of attack is mounted, and it must depend on the reaction of other people as well, because the capture of Hong Kong is not an isolated threat to the United Kingdom, but affects the whole balance of power in the Far East and in Southeast Asia.
This speaker wants to draw on your military ability as well as your knowledge of the area. His question is, in the light of British experience in Malaya, please give us your impression as to U.S. methods in South Vietnam, and would you care to predict as to other techniques which may be employed?
Well, I've seen a lot of the American forces in Vietnam. Over the last 2 years, I've traveled fairly extensively in Vietnam itself, and I've met all the personalities there and almost all the American generals, of all the American generals, and many of the Vietnamese generals. I would like to tell you that I'm immensely impressed with the way in which the thing is going and the way in which it has been handled by the Americans. It's a very tricky situation indeed to try and help people of that sort and tell them what to do without appear to be telling them how to be conducting their operations. And I think the Americans are doing a first-rate job. I think that the policy, that the way that they're doing it is sound. I think that these measures which I talked about, I think the villagization scheme is right. And I think that the way in which the army has been trained is right. I think that the situation has been developed now militarily under which this campaign can be won, but it is a political problem more than it is a military problem. Militarily, you Americans have helped enormously. I must emphasize that all the time, is that Vietnamese who have got to bear the share, that they've got the responsibility, which is the main thing, but you Americans have done an immense amount, and I think that militarily you're well on the road.
Are the main loyalties of the Chinese in Singapore and Malaya directed toward Red China or Free China?
That's a very interesting question. Of course, it's a difficult one to answer. I think that you can't generalize on Chinese. I think that if you try to say the majority, there's no doubt whatsoever that the majority of people of the overseas Chinese live for trade. They've come there to trade, and they want to make money. They want to experience and profit by the peaceful way of life in Malaya. And Malaya is an outstanding example to the whole of Southeast Asia of a contented and happy country. You can travel in safety wherever you want in Malaya. You can walk anywhere you like. You haven't got to have a weapon. You can trade. Anybody can trade freely, and that is highly attractive to the Chinese businessman. I think that the answer to your question, sir, if I may say, is that the Chinese as a race are solidly behind the free world. Let's put it like that, solidly behind the free world way of life. There are Chinese communists. There are remnants from the emergency, but the Chinese communists who brought about the Malayan emergency, they're there still. If they thought they could successfully overturn the government, you couldn't tell what would happen. But the answer to your question is they are aligned with the free world.
This asks you to look in your crystal ball, Sir Nigel, and tell us what will be the outcome of the contest between Mao and Khrushchev. He also comments, Max Frankel has an interesting article in this issue of the Saturday Evening Post.
Between who and Khrushchev? Oh, Mao. Oh, I'm afraid that's really not my question. I think it would be really more profitable if I passed on from that, because that is really just pure conjecture. I think it's terribly interesting. It matters immensely to all of us. But I don't believe that I can really help you very much over that, if you'll excuse me.
Do you think that Australia may become a staging area and possibly eventually a battlefield for Allied military effort in Southeast Asia versus China?
I very much hope that she won't. I very much hope that the situation will develop so that she doesn't need to. And I think that is the important thing. We can't afford to see Vietnam go. We can't afford to see the forward bases which we've got now in the area lost. Singapore is a terribly important base for the fighting of the battle against communism in that area. Now, under the Malayan Treaty of 1957, we were given certain rights to maintain our forces there. Those rights have been discussed recently between UK ministers, United Kingdom ministers, and the Malayan ministers over the new Malayan Treaty. And it has been agreed that we may continue to operate from Singapore in defence of Malaya, in defence of communist interests, and to maintain the peace of Southeast Asia. It's agreed that we may continue to maintain our forces and our base in Singapore for that purpose. We think that we will be able to continue to keep our forces there for that purpose, so long as our aim is consistent with the wishes of the people of that area, and it most certainly will be. So I don't think that we shall lose Singapore in the immediate future. I very much hope, in fact, you must maintain your position as you do now in the parts of which you are interested in, and so I hope that the question that's been put to me, will Australia be used, will not arise. It's a very important place from which support can be given, but it's a long, long way away from the area.
Is it true that the majority of the people of Laos support the communist regime?
It's very difficult to know what a majority of the people in Laos do support. When the coup d'etat took place in 1960 in Laos, and Kong Lee joined up with the neutralists, and then he joined up with the Pepit Lao. He didn't wish to join up with the Pepit Lao, but he was more or less forced, or felt that he was forced to do so, because the alternative was the Fumi government, which he felt unable to support. So he is the split. You get this split now in the neutralist center, which we see going on today. It's really impossible to forecast how it will go. A great deal of help undoubtedly is coming into Laos from outside, and I do think that that Laos is a very, very worrying situation. All of us, anybody who's been connected with Southeast Asia, has been worried for a long time over Laos. We didn't stop our worry after the agreement in Geneva in 1961, but we are worrying very much indeed today.
What about the communist threat to Burma?
It's difficult to describe it quite as a communist threat in Burma. I think that, like many of these emergent nations, Burma would like to reinsure have a foot in both camps. As everybody knows, it was the policy of most of those emerging nations to have a non-alignment. And I think that what you see going on in Burma today is an effort at non-alignment. I was in Burma as recently as the end of January last, only a few months ago, and I saw General Ne Win and all these people, and I found them extraordinarily friendly and extraordinarily open. But all the time was emphasized the desire to non-alignment. They fear the communists. There's no doubt about it. They fear the communists. This recent border agreement has not removed that fear altogether. But they don't feel that they are in a position to have any confrontation with communism, and they want to keep the balance. Whether it's possible for countries in the world today, particularly in that extremely disturbed area, to keep the balance is your judgment as well as anybody else's. But it's a policy, and Ne Win's government is a policy of non-alignment. Whether you think it's a good policy or not, is a different issue. And the way he's carrying out his policy, his nationalization and all that sort of thing, is nothing to do with the communist thing. It's a desire, which you see in many of these parts of the world, to try and remove the trade from the people who have in the past, they think, exploited it, and to bring it into the hands of the local people themselves, if they are able to do so.
This refers to aid. How much credit is given the United States for supplies to the refugees of Hong Kong by British administrators, and what is the proportionate contribution?
This business of the refugees in Hong Kong is a very, very difficult one. Every month we receive into Hong Kong very large numbers of refugees legally. They are allowed over the border, they are resettled, and they are helped in the territory. But Hong Kong is an extremely small territory. It's a territory of only just over 3 million people, a very small acreage. It has a very small water supply, and it cannot sustain a very much bigger population and maintain the standard of living. If the population of Hong Kong were to go up very greatly, very quickly, then there would be a disaster inside. You might then get upheavals, and the situation which we all would wish to see avoided might well occur. And therefore, the immigration into Hong Kong has got to be controlled. What I think the questioner had his mind on is this business last year where very large numbers tried to break in, and they just had to be sent back. They had to be sent back because we couldn't absorb them, and they had to be sent back so that everybody in China didn't think that the way to get out of their villages or their misery in China was to go wholesale onto the borders of Hong Kong. If they did, if we got a wholesale, not invasion, but introduction into Hong Kong of all these people, an immensely serious situation could arise, and the stable territory of Hong Kong, which I think makes a considerable contribution in the Far East, would no longer be stable.
Can you tell us what would be the effect of the fight against communism in Southeast Asia if, one, the United States recognizes Red China, And two, Red China was admitted to the United Nations.
I really don't think that's my question. I'm very sorry. It's a very interesting question that I'd very much like to hear your answers to.
Could the role of the United States Navy be more effective in Southeast Asia, and if so, how?
Well, I think that the Seventh Fleet plays an immense role in security in Southeast Asia. I believe the main factor in security in that area is the realization of the people of that area that they are going to be assisted, and assisted in time, by the people who have defense obligations outside. Well, now, CETO has not lost its importance in any respect, to my mind. But equally important is the sure knowledge that the United States will come quickly to their aid, and we also will come quickly to their aid. All the people who have had, who have undertaken obligations will come to their aid. As I've said, we will continue to honor our obligations, but even so, the position of the United States forces, and I think the Seventh Fleet, which has been particularly mentioned, has an enormous value throughout the area. Even if it doesn't act, everybody knows that it can act, and act damn quickly. Nobody in Southeast Asia wishes to be liberated. There was too much liberation at the end of the war. They want to be protected, and protected in time. And the mobility of the United States Fleet, the Seventh Fleet, gives that capability.
What policy do you suggest towards Sukarno and his affiliates?
Oh, I should hate to suggest. Did you say to Sukarno or from Sukarno?
Toward him.
Towards him.
Our attitude toward him.
Oh, I think that's a very interesting question indeed, and a very fair question. I feel strongly about this. I think that it's very important that the people of Southeast Asia must be got together. Malaysia, when it becomes Malaysia, will be a population of 10 million people. Indonesia today is a population of 100 million people. It's the Muslim population, and so is Malaya, and so is a bit of the Philippines, the bottom bit of the Philippines. And that Muslim population in that part of the world can, in the future, exercise immense importance throughout the area. And I believe we've got to work towards getting this Muslim bloc realizing their responsibilities and the need for their support and stability in the area. I think we must work towards bringing them together. At the present moment, you see this very big communist party in Indonesia, the PKI, is, I think, I may be wrong, I think I'm right in saying the third biggest communist party in the world, but Sukarno is holding the balance between the communist party and the non-communist party, and that's a very important factor. And our interests, I'm not saying what we can do about it, but our interests are that the thing should be maintained without, that it should be that should go the other way eventually. But we mustn't do anything about it. One of the most important things in Asia is not to appear to interfere. The law has got to take its course, but any influence that we can achieve and bring that about will be helpful.
We've run out of time, but we haven't run out of questions nor of interest in this most interesting topic. So, Sir Nigel Poet, we are indebted to you indeed for the very informative and interesting discussion. We thank you very much, and the meeting stands adjourned.